is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Christopher Mason, geneticist, computational biologist, and he is often a principal investigator and co-investigator for NASA. But right now, he's a professor at Weill Cornell Medicine, and he's going to guide us to the next 500 years. That is the title of his new book, subtitled Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Mason, Christopher, congratulations and good evening to you. I want you immediately to take us to the 23rd century. The generation ships that you propose. What is a generation ship, and what are the challenges for the human beings and their colleagues on board that ship as it heads for a new sun? Good evening to you.
Yeah, good evening, and thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. The generation ship is really a culmination of both technological and design and aerospace engineering that will let us get to a point where we can have a whole spacecraft that sends, that is launched towards another star that we've identified that has a habitable planet that eventually the people will get there and begin to explore and have humans exist around the light of a second sun. And to do this, I describe in the book that what this is a generation ship, meaning multiple generations live and die on the same spacecraft, which raises some pretty large ethical questions, but I also address that in the book. I argue it's a moral duty that we have as a species to enable humans to survive beyond this sun, to serve really as guardians and shepherds of life. And so, but to do that, eventually we're going to have to go towards another sun.
You make very clear that an inspiration for this was when you were gifted a copy of Isaac Asimov's Foundation. Foundation series is a vast number of volumes. What in the Foundation still inspires you, Doctor?
Well, one of the most extraordinary things about Isaac Asimov is he was far ahead of his time, that he envisioned an ease with which humans in the future would go between solar systems, go across the galaxy, something kind of like Star Wars in that universe, where it wasn't even considered a big deal to go hop around between stars or planets. And that itself was interesting. But the other thing that was really extraordinary is he had something called prehistory in the book, where he'd recognized that collecting and preserving information was one of the most important things you could do as a species, because without it, you could kind of devolve into more barbarism and lose the technology that let you survive in different planets and places. So his passion for humanity and the value of knowledge are two things I really took from that book and the series. And it really, or even just the hope, that to think that humans will exist that way instills also and assumes a hope that humans can do that, that we won't destroy ourselves, which I also subscribe to.
There are challenges on that generation ship, which we will now address in the intervening three centuries. Distance, energy, and the interstellar medium itself to be able to navigate. Yep. Biological risk, which is enormous, and the target, the goal that you're heading towards. But I want to concentrate on just one that is a challenge to travel from here to low Earth orbit, from here to the moon, and from here to Mars. That's radiation in space. You Yes. propose that there are projects right now, one called PREPARE, that is looking at how human beings can adapt to the radiation in space. What is PREPARE, Chris?
PREPARE is a very interesting program that is trying to prepare, as the name implies, prepare the genetics of human cells, or also learning from other cells, how to respond to radiation when the risk gets really high. So the PREPARE stands for the preemptive expression of radiation responsive elements, basically that you activate genes when you know you're going into a hazardous zone. So what's interesting is this is sponsored by DARPA, the Defense Department, and they're looking at, you know, essentially a way to keep soldiers safe if they go into a radiological hazard, like a nuclear reactor or a nuclear fallout zone, or maybe biological threats, you know, like a virus. And so this is something that we've started doing this in our own lab, where we engineer human cells with genes from tardigrades or other organisms to keep them essentially, to enable them to really survive radiation and even recover faster. So we know we can take lessons from other creatures and either activate genes, which is kind of called epigenetic editing, where you, instead of adding a gene or taking away a gene, you just turn it on. But we also have ways where we can add genes to human cells, even from other creatures, and take their evolutionary lessons of radiation and then bring it into human cells.
You went quickly. Tardigrade. What is that, Chris?
Let me. I'll break it down a little bit. So Really, if the biological risk is one of the biggest ones, it's one of the key hazards identified by NASA and other space agencies, that for long-term space flight, we know there's going to be a lot of radiation that will really ravage cells. We've seen this in the studies we've done on astronauts. And we really have kind of, you have three options generally to try and prevent the radiation. You can actually physically protect against radiation, like a big barrier, like a huge lead block, but that's obviously heavy, and try and get it in space. You can do pharmacological or other, medical countermeasures to some degree on cells that you actually, if you get damaged, there's radiation therapies for it. There are also ways you can try and just repair some of the side effects of reactive oxygen. But the third way is, what if biological? What if we actually activate the genes that are already native to our DNA to enable them to respond faster or better, or really bring the biology from other creatures? And so the tardigrades are one of those creatures we look at that gives us that third method of defense. We say, well, let's take a gene from these creatures. Tardigrades are called water bears. They can survive in the vacuum of space. They're on almost every piece of soil you might look at, these tiny little water bears. They're microscopic. But when you look at them, they're eukaryotic, so they're multicellular complex organisms. They look like tiny bears, and they can walk. But they can even survive in the vacuum of space. They kind of get dried out and desiccated. You can bring them back into the space station, rehydrate them, or bring them back down to Earth, and they'll start walking around again. Now, not all of them. They don't all survive. But the fact that they can survive both the vacuum of space and huge amounts of radiation has given us a lot of clues in the past few years about what we could maybe learn from them. So we took one of the genes found in them that's called DSUP, or DNA damage suppressor protein, and put it into human cells, and we can see an 80% reduction in DNA damage, and that it's stable. It stays that way. So it's really an extraordinary piece of cell work in our lab that shows this is possible.
So here in the early 21st century, we already are taking steps towards radiation defenses in interstellar space. One more detail before we plunge into what you do, which is the editing of the genome. What is deontogenic ethics?
Yeah, I wanted to propose a new framework that would drive this thinking. Okay, you think, well, how do we have a moral argument for us to go out into space? Not just a technical one, or the common one is that we should explore space just because, or why did you climb Mount Everest just because, which I think is okay, but it's not as, I think, internally consistent or frankly as inspiring as to think, like, what if this is actually a duty for our species? So Immanuel Kant wrote a lot about basically the what is duty, and think about the categorical imperative was his ethical framework, because it's when you were a kid, someone would say, well, if you stole a candy bar, what if everybody stole a candy bar? What would the world look like? And so he talked about deontology, or this idea of what is your duty, essentially, for that ethical framework. The other thing people think about ethics is, well, what if you put the greatest good for the greatest number? Or that is also described as Mill's utilitarian ethics. And so these are two frameworks that I describe a bit in the book, but neither one of them explicitly address spaceflight or humans going to other planets. What I wanted to do is think, what's something that's even before those two frameworks, it's antecedent necessarily to them, is what is our duty as a species to our own DNA, or to all other creatures' DNA, or really to any life form, including someday potentially AI-based life forms. So I call it a deontogenic ethical framework, or sort of a genetic duty. And I argue that because we are the only species that knows about extinction and the loss of life, or the loss of entire species and ecosystems, only we can prevent, and that gives us a duty and really responsibility to serve as these kind of guardians, if you will, guardians of the galaxy, quite frankly, quite directly. And it means that this is unique to us today, but might not always be. But I propose this as a necessary duty, not just out of survival, which of course would help us survive, as thinking about how do we preserve our ecosystems and resources, but also helps us preserve life in the universe, which as far as we know is extremely rare. So as far as we know, it's only here. And so I think this gives us a real unique duty and responsibility, which is the genetic duty, deontogenic ethical framework. And genic is the genetic, and deontos are your duty, and the ontological framework behind it.
If I understand correctly, it isn't the utilitarianism of the 18th century, Jeremy Bentham, the greatest good for the greatest number. It is to do what is necessary to preserve life in the galaxy as long as possible, as long as we can imagine it.
Yes, and from that flows all the other ethical frameworks. But I like to say that the existence precedes the essence. Unless we exist, we cannot have either ethical framework. And there are also some other benefits to that. We survive. We also learn about how to explore life and change it.
Let us plunge into what you do in your lab all the time, and what you geneticists know are the miracles that are commonplace now for DNA and for the cell and for cellular life. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Christopher Mason is the author, a geneticist, a computational biologist, a professor at the Weill Cornell Medicine. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.